Hello everybody and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, I'm recording on Saturday the 13th of April out in Reykjavik, Iceland as always. It's a beautiful sunny spring day out here. And I think we have a good episode this week. We have some news. The Triple I Initiative launched this week, which is a collective of indie developers who all banded together to do a showcase. We saw some interesting games, but there was also a bit of a homogenous feel to them all, so I've got some thoughts about that. I've been continuing to play Dragon's Dogma 2, or at least I had my second session with the game after my 4-hour binge when it first came out, so I've got some further thoughts about that game. And we will round things out with a review of Children of the Sun, the latest game from Devolver Digital. I've been playing that one and having a lot of fun with it. It's a really interesting game, so I'm looking forward to telling you all about that. But I have added a few games to the slate. A few new codes came in, so I now have downloaded Botany Manor, the game that just came out on Game Pass. I'm looking forward to playing that one after enjoying the demo. That's the gardening game set in a mansion where you have to use plants to solve puzzles. I've also downloaded Broken Roads. This is an interesting wasteland-style isometric RPG. It looks really interesting. It has a moral choices system, and it's set in post-apocalyptic Australia. I actually got a code for that one on Steam, first of all, but I tried to play it on my Ally. I found the text size a little bit difficult on that small screen, so I've downloaded it to Xbox as well. So if you are thinking of playing Broken Roads, I recommend playing it on a big screen rather than a handheld. And I'm also still chipping away at Pepper Grinder. I'm on the second world, I think. I'm just approaching the second boss. I'm enjoying playing that one in short bursts, and I will review that at some point too, so expect to hear about all those games in the future. So with that housekeeping out of the way, let's move on to the first item, the Triple I Initiative. This seems pretty interesting. It came up on social media last month. Suddenly loads of good developers, like the people behind Slay the Spire, the people behind Spiritfarer, Thunder Lotus, Ponkle, the developers of Vampire Survivors, and many more, all simultaneously posted about the Triple I Initiative, so it was on the radar straight away. It was a pretty effective launch, I thought. They announced their first event, and it went down. It seems to be a showcase that is a reaction to the mainstream model that we see at Summer Games Fest and the Game Awards and all of these kind of things, which are apparently very expensive to take part in. You often hear developers say that they applied and didn't get in, or were offered a slot in those showcases that was too much money. So I think it seems really cool for indie developers to band together and use their platform to combine and to reach a larger collective audience. There were a bunch of game announcements. We got a first announcement of Slay the Spire 2, a really exciting one. They opened up the show with that one. And I'm on the record as being a pretty huge Slay the Spire fan, and I'm even having a bit of a deck builder moment right now. So this was great news. It was a short teaser trailer. It showed one of the characters from the original game, and also some new ones, which is quite exciting as each character comes with different cards and different builds and different strategies. So it's fun that we'll have some of the old and some of the new. It was a pretty short teaser trailer, but we did find out that it's going to go into early access next year. So this was just a first taste. It was a teaser and an announcement that that game is under development. I think the second biggest announcement was The Rogue Prince of Persia. We just got a 2D Prince of Persia game this year in The Lost Crown, but like London Buses, we now have another one coming too. This one is from the Dead Cells team, and it's made in collaboration with Ubisoft. It looks like Ubisoft will be publishing it as well. And it wasn't the only partnership that we saw, so it's interesting that Triple I, or at least this clique of developers that have banded together for this initiative, are looking towards Triple A and more traditional large-scale game publishers to tap that IP and bring it into their games, which is kind of interesting. But as for the game, we saw some slick gameplay. It has a very clean, illustrated art style that seems to hark back to the original Prince of Persia style from back in the day. It had very mobile, athletic gameplay with lots of flips and slides, and it looked fast and fluid and sleek. But you do worry for it a little bit in that there has just been a very successful and acclaimed Prince of Persia game. So maybe people have had their fill of that, but it is a roguelike. And apparently they worked alongside Ubisoft as the two games were in development at the same time to make sure that they were distinguished enough from each other. We all get to find out on May the 14th when that game comes into early access. We also got an announcement for Never Alone 2. This is a sequel to the 2014 puzzle platformer. These are games based on indigenous Alaskan mythology, which is a great, rich seam of subject matter. And it was hard to tell from the animated cutscene that we got, the CG cutscene, but it did seem to have more of a 3D feel to it than the original game, so I'm curious what the gameplay will look like for that one. We also saw two RTS games. One was Dino Lords, which joins the exoprimal trend and has dinosaurs charging through medieval castle walls and dinosaur-riding warriors and stuff. The other one was Cataclysmo, a tower defense RTS where you have to build the towers brick by brick and then try and defend them as they get knocked down and stuff like that. That one had a sandboxy look about it, Cataclysmo. As for the other game announcements, we saw Kill Knight, which looks like a Fast and Furious dungeon crawler with a glitchy gothic art style. That looked cool. We saw Undermine 2. I haven't played the original, but that's another roguelike dungeon crawler with cartoony graphics and apparently multiplayer. And there was also a game announcement for something called RKGK, or Rakugagi, which is a 3D action platformer with parkour, rail grinding, graffiti, and a cool cyberpunk world. No gameplay for that one, but it did look very cool. There were also some looks at things we've seen before. Shadows of Doubt had a trailer. No release date still, but that looks really cool. It's that voxel city immersive sim investigation game where you have to go around the city investigating people, thread your clues together, and that sort of thing. We got another look at Hyper Light Breaker, which is coming into early access this summer, and another look at Mouse, which is an FPS with a Steamboat Mickey visual style. So there's no doubt that there was a lot of good games in the showcase, but I came away feeling a little lukewarm about it, I think because of the range of games on show. It was very heavy on dungeon crawlers, it was very heavy on sequels, there was lots of DLC for things like Vampire Survivors, and I think I was just hoping to be a little more engaged, a little more shocked to see something new. I think that the thing that I love about indie games most of all is that they are creative, they are unpredictable, and we see things that we don't see in other spaces. If I think back about my games of the year, it's often been things like Immortality, which is just a completely unique game that we haven't seen before, and Inscription, which was just a crazy thing, really. It was very experimental. Even if it did lean on deck building and escape room stuff, it was just a really artistic, creative game, which is, you know, it's what I always say at the top of every episode. So it does feel a little bit weird to be critical of the AAA initiative, and I am broadly supportive of it, as I said. It does seem like a good idea for indie developers to create their own showcase platform. But the games that were on show were pretty conservative in terms of genre. A lot of them blended together, I thought. But there is some context for that. I was listening to the Sifter podcast. If you don't listen to Sifter, I really recommend it. They have a weekly news show that's just 10 minutes long. It's like a bite-sized news gulp. They have developer interviews and they do game reviews as well. And on the latest episode of their Lightmap interview podcast, they interviewed someone from Den of Geeks, the Australian development house that made Solium Infernum recently. And the studio head was very, very candid and open about the financial difficulty that the studio has been in, and about how even if you're coming off the back of a successful game, you don't necessarily have 3 years of money in the tank to keep the studio running when you have 70 people like they do. So it did make me wonder if the reason that indie studios are starting to lean on the reliable, the proven genres that they know there is a big audience for in this post-Hades, post-Vampire Survivor scenario that we are right now, is maybe a pragmatic response to a difficult climate for game studios, especially these AAA or established ones that have presumably picked up a lot of staff, you know, and grown over the time. But it was interesting anyway, you know, it was food for thought, and there was a lot of good games in there, so that was the AAA showcase. If you want to see it, you can stream the whole thing on YouTube, and there's a lot of news stories about all of the games that were there, and all of the individual trailers have now gone up too. I will be very curious to see what's up at WASD, the WASD festival that I'm going to in London later this month, and to just take the temperature of the scene and see what kind of games people are making. But that was the AAA showcase. The next item that I have is Dragon's Dogma 2. I spoke about this one when it first came out. I opened it up just to test it out, and then 4 hours later I was still playing. I talked about it, I think, 2 episodes ago, if you would like to hear my initial thoughts. And I was really looking forward to getting back into it, actually, so I finally got around to a second session, and I sat down and played for a few more hours. If you've played the game, you will know that fast travel is interesting in this game. You can't fast travel in the traditional sense of just hitting a button and popping up somewhere else on the map. There is actually an ox cart system where you hitch a ride on an ox cart. You can choose to sleep. Sometimes on the journey, you will wake up if there is a monster attack and you'll have to hop off and help defend the cart and that sort of thing. And then afterwards, you will get a choice. You're like, do I want to get back onto the cart and go back to sleep? Or do I want to continue on foot? So I decided to have an adventure. I was halfway to the capital, I looked at my map, and I thought, I'm going to walk the rest of the way and just see what is in this world. Straight away, I got into some interesting scrapes. There were some monsters battling some people next to a wooden bridge over a deep ravine. So I decided to go and help the people out. I charged over the bridge, we fended off the monsters. But during the battle, the bridge got taken out. It's an interesting emergent possibility that your progress through the game, the routes that are open to you, are destructible in that way. So I certainly got the adventure that I was looking for. I continued down the left-hand side of the ravine. There were battles, there were groups of monsters. There was a day-night cycle too. There are campsites everywhere where you have to rock up and use your camping equipment to set up camp. That's when you get to fully recharge all of your health. So it has a dual health bar system that I'm not sure about yet. If you take damage, your maximum health will slowly shrink. So you can't fully heal all the time. I think I actually prefer the traditional system of just being able to use your potions and heal up and continue. And that's because I got into a bit of a scrape, actually. I was progressing through the game, getting closer and closer to the capital. I got to see the view of the capital, which looked beautiful from far away. The draw distance and the weather effects in this game are really, really stellar. But I'd been battling my way through a bunch of monsters, and eventually my health started to get really, really low, actually. I came across a field boss and battled it for a while. We lost a lot of health and we ended up running away. Found a campsite, set up camp for the night, and I was like, okay, this is great, we will heal, we'll go back and finish off that boss, and we'll continue on our way. But it turns out that if you have not fully cleared an area of monsters, you can suffer night raids. So I got set upon by a bunch of monsters that had been in the area, and they it was a tense battle. We were on low health. And then the next day, after we dispatched the monsters, I noticed that we hadn't fully healed, so I tried to set up camp and couldn't. It turns out that if you get hit with a night raid, your camping supplies can be destroyed, which means no more full healing. So I found myself in this difficult situation of being, the way forward was packs of monsters, the way back had this field boss and loads of roaming beasts. So I tried to go forward and died a few times, tried to go back, died a few times, tried to stealth around the monsters to try and get back to the nearest town, which was actually quite far away by now. But after I think about 10 attempts to get back on track and to try and escape this little knot that I was in, I just ran out of ideas, basically. All of my companions were getting killed with one hit. My health was rock bottom, and I couldn't heal up because of the double health bar system. And I ended up reloading my save, which was actually 2 hours back. It auto-saves very regularly, and the auto-save had saved very recently, so that was no use to me. And you get these in-saves when you're in a town. It's like a permanent save, like a backstop. And so I ended up having to revert to that save, which meant I'd lost all of the progress, all of the items I'd found, all of the chests I'd discovered, all of the levels that I had gone up through combat. It was really disheartening, actually, and I got back on the ox cart to the capital, and this time I just didn't get off. So I arrived in the capital having had my long adventure in the wilderness kind of deleted from the game's canon. So I closed the game. I thought, you know what, I feel pretty disheartened with this. I lost all my progress. I'm in the capital, but I'm feeling pretty demotivated right now. And I haven't gone back to it since then, so I'm going to put Dragon's Dogma 2 on the back burner, at least until I calm down and get my mojo back for the game. Because I think there's no question that it's a good game. It has Skyrim vibes. It has Bethesda / FromSoft vibes. I think it feels like some kind of Skyrim Elden Ring mashup with a really great medieval visual style and a really interesting world and a good story. So I want to get back to it, but the dual health bar system and the campfire system just bummed me out a little bit. I felt like the game could have given me a way out or a heads up at least. So that's my update on Dragon's Dogma 2. And the final little item I have here in this extended intro is just to thank all of the show's latest patrons. We've had a fair few new patrons joining recently, so thank you very much to Liz, thank you very much to Steve and JD, all of whom signed up for Patreon at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. They all immediately received an invite to the patron-only Discord server, which is popping lately, there's loads going on in there. They also got access to a bunch of patron-only episodes, including music shows, radio show-style things, travelogue-style things, literature reviews. And I really appreciate the support. As you may know, I was one of the video game layoffs that we've heard so much about lately, so it's really nice to have a little trickle of cash coming in from the podcast. So thanks to those patrons. Thanks to all my existing patrons who make the Discord such a nice place to be. Big thank you to Soccer, Dovetail, Real Dave Jackson, Grabloid, Justin, Narita Boy, all of the people who are in there every day chatting, talking about games. And you are welcome to come and join us. It's patreon.com/gamingintheWild. It's only $1 a month or more if you want, and you get all of those perks and you get to support this podcast. That's my Patreon section out of the way, so let's move on and talk about the featured game of this episode, Children of the Sun. So Children of the Sun is a stylish sniper game made by solo developer Rene Ruther. It has a really stellar, really engaging, ambient doom rock soundtrack by Aidan Baker, who I hadn't heard about before, but I looked up and I will be checking out their solo work as well. It's published by the ever-reliable Devolver Digital. It came out on April the 9th. It's only on Steam for now, but I'm sure that console versions will follow. I played this one on the ROG Ally, and it ran perfectly. But I will mention that I watched friend of the show Blinkoom, aka Steve, from the Polykill and IndieQuest podcasts, playing on Twitch. And Steve was having a much easier time than I did. He was playing using a mouse on PC, I guess, and I think that the mouse controls for spinning bullets around mid-air and things like that seemed to make for a much easier time than what I was doing on controller. So that's worth bearing in mind, maybe if you are someone that has access to a PC who can play on mouse, you might have an easier time with the controls. How Long to Beat has this one at a pretty breezy 3 to 6 hours, based on how completionist you are feeling. I've played 4 hours of it, and I am 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through the game. I think there are 26 missions in total, and they do offer some replayability to improve your times and so forth. This one has a healthy Metacritic 82. It has almost universally positive reviews. I think the lowest was a 7. And the NME said that it is equal parts revenge epic and gory brain teaser. Children of the Sun is an utter thrill that will leave you desperate for more. Rock, Paper, Shotgun were a little more measured. They said it's original and well-crafted with bags of style, but they also said some levels need a lot of restarts that suck the joy out of all the wanton murder. And I have to agree with both of those. I agree with the praise, and I do sympathise with that critique as well, which I will get to. But first things first, what is Children of the Sun? It's a game in which you play as the girl, an escapee from a cult called the Children of the Sun. Some bad stuff seems to have gone down in this cult. I will say up top, this is a very gritty, grimy, nasty feeling game. I saw one review of it that said it's the feel-bad game of the year, which I thought was a really funny way to put it. There are hints of abusive stuff, pretty out there abusive stuff that went down in this cult, so a slight content warning for this game if you are averse to creepy cult shit. I would say it's in the same lane as things like True Detective Season 1 and maybe Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that feeling of weird things happening in the deep American outback. And it does have a pretty pungent kind of atmosphere. It's a pretty engrossing atmosphere that the game creates. It's horror adjacent, I would say. And playing as the girl, you are going on a mission to eradicate the cult that you have escaped from by taking them out wherever you find them, one magic bullet at a time. And I have touched on it just now, but the atmosphere of this game is really worth mentioning. It has a really brilliant art style. It's graphically simple in a way that I quite like, with simple polygonal models. They are rough and lurching and a bit jank in a really fun way. The cult members are golden and faceless, and they walk around doing their little tasks in their scenarios that they are in. The scenery is simple. The music varies between foreboding fingerpicked guitar like we just heard and squalls of electronic noise. And the colour palette is really deep purple. It reminds me a little bit of Sayonara Wild Hearts, but whereas that one had a dreamlike sheen to the whole game, this one has a nightmarish quality. I've kind of christened the purple that they use as Nightmare Purple. The cutscenes are really, really atmospheric too. They have animated cutscenes where you see flashbacks, trauma flashbacks to things that went down in the cult, strange dreams and little glimpses at the girl's origin story. It's kind of heavy, and it does have some emotional edge to it, I think. I felt slightly on edge playing it. I felt slightly nervous playing it, and that's a really interesting response to have to the game. I think that all of the little decisions that have been taken here with sound, the art style, the backstory, it adds up to a very foreboding energy. And you see a little map. It's more like a little trail with levels that you can click on. Between levels, there are little cutscenes where the girl is cleaning her gun or playing a different kind of video game, like a game in a game kind of thing. But once you've selected a level, you go into one of the stylish sniper missions that you're going to have to take care of to complete the game. At the start of each scene, you are standing at distance, crouching usually behind a bush or something, and you can push left or right. The girl will scout the perimeter. She will walk around the edge of the scene. You run left and right around the edge of the area, whether it's a watchtower or a farm or an occupied warehouse with some delivery stuff going on, or a train station with loads of cult members hanging around on platforms and bridges and things like that. The game does helpfully tell you out of the gate on each level how many targets there are to take out, and you have to get them all. But it doesn't tell you where they are, so you have to run around, you can zoom in down your sniper scope, you can mark each cult member, so you'll get a little blip on the screen. So you'll always know where they are if you've marked them. It's really important to do your homework before you fire your shot. And I have, like, good thoughts and bad thoughts about how this works. Like, there are some nice touches, like the Nightmare Purple backgrounds are deep and dark, and the cult members are bright gold, which makes them pop against the scenery, which is very, very important. They can still be hard to spot, I would say to a fault at times, but the game does seem to know that that is a thing. So there's also a little bit of haptic feedback when your crosshair is near a target, so you know that someone is in the area, which helps with this initial scouting phase. And when you are as satisfied as you can be and you found as many cult members as you can, ideally you will have found them, marked them all, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you just have to shoot your shot and try and find the missing ones as the bullet flies, because what happens next is that you aim down the sights, choose your first target, and then pull the trigger. And when you do so, the camera will snap to the path of the bullet. So you are seeing the bullet in the air, you're racing along at high speed behind it. And when you hit your first target, they will gorily explode and ragdoll spectacularly. And then everything snaps into bullet time. It goes into extreme slow motion. So the carnage that you've just caused is happening in balletic kind of style. And this is where the main mechanic of the game comes into play, because it is a magic bullet game. You only get one shot. And the girl has the ability to alter the path of a bullet mid-air to make it change direction when it has hit someone, to make it dodge and weave in the air, like the JFK magic bullet theory. So after you've had a hit, the cultist counter will go down by one. You have to adjust your path in mid-air, find the next one, and then release, and the bullet will fly again and hit the next person. And as a central mechanic, this is really cool. It feels original. I haven't seen anything quite like this before. It's very satisfying to do. There is a great pop sound when you hit someone. The sound design in this game is really, really good. It's really impactful, I would say. And the way that the targets ragdoll is very, very cool. You are causing carnage with every shot. And you zigzag between targets, picking them off one by one until they're all gone and the word dead flashes up on the screen. And after you've completed each level, you will get rated on performance, which includes things like the time you have taken, how many times you change direction or hit explosive items, things like that. So there is some replayability here if you want it. I think perfection is attainable in these levels, but as a player, I was quite happy to muddle through them personally, to complete each level, solve the puzzle of the level, to move on and see what was next. And from time to time between the levels, new mechanics are introduced, like hitting a car's fuel cap will explode a vehicle, which can take out multiple enemies in the nearby region. That also makes them very useful as alternate freezing points, like if you can't see the next cultist, you can maybe blow up a car and then see what the view is like from there. And the sound does a lot of heavy lifting here. I'm going to play you a little bit of what it sounds like when you start hitting cars and cultists, because it's quite a sound. So each of those drum beats that you are hearing is the moment when you strike a cultist and kill them. And it adds this sort of terrible weight to the whole thing. I really like it. It's scary. It's deep somehow. But as I was saying, yeah, you do get new mechanics throughout the game. You are taught that you can hit birds in the air and you can also use them as a stopping point. That lets you navigate over large obstacles like houses and so forth. And I won't spoil all of the abilities that you get, but you will learn how to bend shots a little in mid-air to control the path of the bullet, which affords you more control, allows you to weave in and out of rooms through windows, to shoot almost around corners. It's a little tight cone of movement that you get, but it's enough to really open things up. And the levels start out really simple and fun. I think the earlier levels were actually my favorite, where you do your scouting, you tag your targets, you shoot your shot, and then you get it done. They are all puzzles, and they do ramp up. You have to figure out how to hit every target in sequence, and that gets more complicated as areas get bigger, as you have enemies standing on buildings or overpasses or looking out of windows or moving enemies or enemies who are patrolling in sequence. So you have to wait for the right time. There are also enemies in moving vehicles, drifting around. There are cultists with impenetrable front-facing shields, so you're going to have to take those ones out from behind and weave that into your strategy. And there are some increasingly complicated and tricky obstacles, like moving trains that will flash across the tracks at certain periods, blocking your shot. But I have personally found that the harder the levels got, and as they grew in complexity, it got harder to try and pass them. It got harder to spot all of the cultists, and so I'll give an example. The seventh level is called the Occupied Village. This is the first difficult level, I would say. I was having trouble scouting all of the targets at first. Some of them are hidden in houses. And so you can only see a sliver of them from a very specific spot, and they can be easy to miss. There are other golden points of light too that confuse things a little, like lanterns or streetlights. And when you're looking from far away, it's hard to tell sometimes if a golden glow that you can see is the presence of a cultist or just a lantern that someone's left on a table. And this might be that I was playing on a handheld, and so I was playing on a fairly small screen. But it did get a little frustrating, I would say, when it take out five of the six guys and then repeatedly fail, because you just can't find the last target. You didn't find them in your scouting. It's a complex environment. And so you have to just speculatively shoot into different houses. A good thing is that if you do hit a target, it will be automatically tagged for your next attempt. So that's a good little nod to the fact that if you can't scout everyone in the first instance, you can scout them mid-run, and then you will have that information for your next attempt. And I really do think that mileage might vary on that. I think perfectionists might enjoy the slow discovery of the more complex levels and replaying levels over and over, trying to trim their time down and find the best possible path, and even maybe taking on the leaderboards. But I was definitely having the most fun when I was flying through the levels quickly, and I had less and less fun as they got more complicated. But I did keep pressing on, not least because of the story. It's told in vivid cutscenes and flashbacks between missions in a scribbly, disturbing, animated art style. And it fills in the blanks of what happened leading up to this situation, the girl and her childhood, her mistreatment at the hands of the cult, the story of her family, and what has sent her on this quest. We see her discovering her ability to first control bullets midair. We see images of her talking to the cult leader. It's visually very cool, and it's vague but intriguing. And I really did like the between-level scenes, like where she's dreaming of the cult and we walk through a dream, when she's cleaning her rifle and we have to manually do that, or when there's another video game that is on screen, like a little arcade-style retro minigame that you have to complete to move on to the next level. I should also mention that as you complete levels, the camera will zoom out to a bird's eye top-down aerial view of the map, and you then get to see the path that your bullet took through the level. So you get to see every impact point and the shape that the path of your bullet drew. Another really nice touch, I think. So moving on to the positives and negatives, and to round out my thoughts on this one, I think the art, the sound, the music, and the gameplay are all super strong. It's an aesthetic success. It feels original. I like the gameplay loop. The magic bullet gameplay is very satisfying. It's satisfying when you have a point of impact and you get that drum sound in the Ape Out style. The slow motion and bullet time is satisfying in that super hot kind of way. And I like seeing targets scatter. Like if you explode a car, take out two guys, then the nearby cultists who didn't get killed will run away in super slow motion and you just hunt them down with the bullet. Very, very fun. I like that it introduces new abilities from time to time, like weaving in and out of buildings with your magic bullet. Felt great when you get it right. And there is some satisfaction to solving a puzzle if it's not too dense. And finally, just to reiterate that the vibe really carries this game along. The between-level cutscenes are really cool. It has a great art house movie kind of feel to it. I like that foreboding, swampy kind of feeling. You feel deep into something kind of unholy in this game, like a revenge quest that is just not good in any way. But as a game experience, it is good. It's a good thing to experience. It's a different tone than I've experienced in most games that I've played. I will say that this is just a very imaginative and stylish production from bottom to top, so bravo to René Ruther for this one. As for the negatives, I did feel like the game jams the brakes on sometimes in the increasingly complex levels. It's one of those games that is fun when it's going well, and then gets frustrating, increasingly frustrating when it's not. I feel that the enemy placement, even with their bright gold pop against that nightmare purple background, did get a bit Where's Wally at times. And I'm highly allergic to hidden object games, so the hidden object aspect of this game was not my favourite. So I think that the enemy placement gets a little bit too convoluted and obtuse, and it slows the game down in a way that I was not a fan of. The only other criticism I've got really is that the action can get a little hard to pass when there's a lot going on. So if you hit a car, you hit a gas canister, You hit a cultist, everything is flying through the air, there is fire, and it blocks your view sometimes. So I sometimes found my bullets just hovering in slow motion, waiting to get a clear line of sight on the next guy. So there was a little bit of visual clutter in the heat of it all. But overall, I think this is a very compelling game. I think it's well worth checking out. It's the kind of game that makes me love indie games. It's a real oddity. It has a lot of style and panache. It is the kind of oddball indie game that makes indie games great. It's the kind of thing that I would have liked to see in that Triple I showcase at the start of the show. So if this sounds at all interesting to you, I think it's only $15 to get the game. And I think it is really, really compelling. If you like the sound of it, pick it up and support these kinds of releases. That is Children of the Sun. So that's our episode for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. It was fun talking out my thoughts about the Triple I initiative, about my Dragon's Dogma travails, and finally my experience with the pretty interesting Children of the Sun. I will mention in this wrap-up that I've posted a few new videos to the YouTube channel lately. It's still all guns blazing in terms of posting regular videos. There have been some lately about mini open worlds, about my favourite deck builders, about my favourite visual novels. I think you could think of the YouTube channel as a place to find sort of 5 to 10 minute extra podcasts, basically, because it is just me talking about games after all. And also, I hit the milestone to monetize the channel lately, and since I got laid off, that has been my self-appointed side quest to just make videos, have fun making them, hone down my content skills in a way, which is a good CV item, but also to monetize the channel and maybe open up another little trickle of income from making video game content. So if you'd like to see that, I will put a YouTube link to the YouTube channel in the comments. Please do click through. Subs are appreciated, comments, all of that jazz. If you are listening on Spotify, you can give the podcast a star rating, which helps more people to find it. If you are listening on Apple, you can add a review, and that helps people find it too. So I appreciate all of that stuff. The Patreon exists as well. It's patreon.com/gamingintheWild. And you can email me if you have any thoughts about the show at johnisgamingintheWild@gmail.com. And with that, I will wrap things up. Not sure what next week's show is yet. It might be Botany Manor, or maybe I will get sucked into Broken Roads, or even finish Pepper Grinder, or who knows, maybe I'll find my footing again with Dragon's Dogma 2. I sure hope so. But that's our show for this week, so take care of yourselves and each other. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye for now.